Hello, and welcome to Curiosity Conversations with me, Scott Drummond. It's January, still January, almost at the end, and that means the topic we're exploring is courage, and helping me to explore that topic today is Catherine. Catherine's been a journalist, is the founder and CEO of a sustainability company, advises large companies and small on credibility, messaging, positioning, and she's also a certified trauma-informed coach. She coaches leaders and change makers to help them make the most of the opportunities they have to make change in their own lives and in the world. Catherine, welcome.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Not at all. It's my absolute pleasure. I just, you know, literally just going through that bio, you think, whoa, there's a lot of juicy material to jump into there. I guess, you know, One question I often ask people in this is, what's your first memory of courage? But I think I want to start somewhere else, in fact, and just start where we are right now and say to you, how is courage kind of front and center for you at the moment?
I mean, I won't do it to you, but this could be the shortest episode of your show ever, because for me, the absolute bottom line right now is courage is just being alive and showing up every day, and especially now. Of course, we can talk about grand moments of courage and how courage shows up differently at different times in our lives and for different people. But, you know, we're under chronic stress, basically, with the pandemic. And then if you look at all the other systemic challenges that we're facing, I think it's totally courageous just showing up every day. Sometimes you need to retreat, sometimes you need to reset, and other times you're able to get back into it. But just the fact of showing up to me is always so important.
And I've wrestled a little bit with this term trauma, in fact, you know, not wrestled with it per se, but it covers quite a broad range of different things. And I've had some discussions with people in the work that I do with dads around fatherhood. Sometimes I think the experience of being a parent is a sort of low-level trauma. It's a feeling of being overwhelmed and under-resourced kind of permanently. I wondered if that word trauma kind of is the right word to describe the times we're living through right now.
I think this is an extended period of stress. This is chronic stress. And for some people, that is traumatic. I think, you know, collectively as a society, we're in uncertainty, we're under pressure, there's a lot of fear and a lot of isolation. And so, I mean, it does feel to me like an experience which is going to be traumatic for many people. I mean, you touched on something about trauma, and there tends to be different schools of thought, if you like, in the world of trauma. I mean, I'm a trauma-informed coach, so I'm not a therapist, but for me, it was really important that the training I did would be as aligned as possible to what people were going through. You know, if you set out as a coach or any other kind of helping profession, for me, it was never my goal to make it worse for people. So I thought I need to be as informed as possible. But I've come across those discussions about it. Sometimes in the training, they would even talk about trauma with a little T or trauma with a big T. The fact is that our bodies, the way that we are wired, we respond to threats. So it doesn't matter what that threat is. Right. It's all about our programming and our survival. We are wired for survival. So you might think it's trauma, someone else might not. It doesn't matter. You know, if for you it's a traumatic experience, or for someone else, then it is.
And you know, that really resonates as well, because in the conversations I've had around courage and in my reading and writing around this topic, what keeps coming up and what keeps kind of making itself clear is that courage is a very personal topic. You know, we could talk about things that we might generally agree are, you know, objectively courageous, but actually, you know, what we're talking about here is each individual in their current circumstance, surrounded by the situation they're in, you know, is probably showing courage in many different ways. And it's not really appropriate or necessarily helpful for us to kind of compare the levels of courage.
That's comparing levels of courage is like comparing levels of trauma. My trauma is bigger than your trauma, and that just doesn't serve anybody. We're all struggling with our own stuff, not just what's going on at the moment, but we've all got our you know, baggage and our things that we've lived with. And I think it takes true courage to go at your own pace, and it takes true courage to know when you need to retreat and reset, and to really do the work to start to let go of some of these things which are holding us back. And I don't think that the definition is necessarily helpful. And certainly when people start to try to shame, I've actually seen trauma shaming going on. People saying, oh, you can't talk about trauma, you don't know anything about it. You know, I've had real traumatic experiences. But the fact is that our neurobiology, our nervous system, all of that is rigged for survival. And so anything that puts us into a situation where we're afraid, where we feel threatened, our body responds the same way, whether it's a six-year-old that lost its parent in a supermarket or somebody who's gone through, you know, war or other, you know, really impactful experiences. It can be loss, it can be grief, it can all be traumatic. And I think actually sticking the trauma label on it doesn't necessarily help, but for me it's more about knowing when I work with people, helping them to see that whatever they bring is welcome and that there are no taboos. And if they come to talk to me about whatever it is, they don't have to keep sides of themselves hidden. You know, I don't want someone coming, oh, but I can't mention that because that's a bit, you know, taboo, or she might not know that. Or there's, you know yourself, you're a brilliant coach, Scott. When you're in that coaching space, everything is welcome.
And in fact, you know, everything is useful. I think it's welcome. And also, you know, how often, I mean, I know this personally, I've seen it in my work as well, and I'm sure that, you know, you'll recognize this too. How often do we think the things that make us weak, or we think the things that are our darker elements that we don't want to share, they're actually tremendous resources, but we need to go there. You know, we need to find our the topics that are difficult for us. And once we kind of integrate them, once we bring them closer to ourselves, once we feel comfortable to welcome even that part of ourselves, to offer even that part of ourselves some love and affection, it's amazing how often, you know, that becomes one of our greatest resources.
Yeah, but isn't that the hardest thing to do? I mean, I think you have to build some resilience before you can necessarily go there, and there'll be some things where you can go and some things where you still can't. And it's a process. I think they're layers, right? I always talk about the infinite onion. It's this onion where you just keep peeling off the layers and they never end. You know, it's just layer after layer. And being able to recognize when you let things go.
Right. And I love the point you made earlier about this, which in a way I think is kind of the whole deal, which is you have to go at your own pace. I'm really conscious in having these conversations with people that I try not to kind of valorize or set up on a pedestal this idea that, you know, courage is really great and we must all show courage and get out of our comfort zone. I think actually that's a sort of toxic way of thinking about this topic that leads people to push themselves. And it's where things like vulnerability stray into kind of, you know, emotional performance of sorts. I think that can be a really dangerous space. And, you know, we're overexposed to this stuff, you know, every podcast, articles, etc., you know, show us the benefits of doing the work. And I, you know, how often do I encounter people who feel they're almost judging themselves for not having been more courageous in facing their demons. So by the time they arrive, on top of, you know, whatever the challenges are that they're facing, whatever emotional debt they're carrying, they're also layering on guilt and a sense of, you know, I'm not good enough to even do the work. And I just, you know, my wish, I guess, for all of my clients is to be patient, you know, to the things that remain unsolved. There's a great Rilke quotation: be patient to all the things that remain unsolved in your heart. You know, I think there are times to go deep and do that work, and other times when, you know, it's not time to dig up things from our past or traumatic events. I'm conscious of one thing in this conversation, which is we are in the middle of this stuff right now, as you said. So and we're live, right? So this is a great moment to be where we are. And I'm curious. A good friend, Johnny Miller, he recently released a resilience report, a report into founder resilience, with a great entrepreneur called Jan Chipchase from Studio D. And in this report, they talked about this concept of emotional debt, the kind of the small minor emotional situations that, people, and context, people in the workplace, have kind of emotionally taxing situations happening a lot. You know, every day there'll be something, some minor indiscretion, some difficult conversation. And over time, if we're not actively processing some of this emotional debt, it can build and build and build to a level that becomes kind of not small, but actually unsustainable. And so I'm actually really, you know, building on what you said about, you know, courage really these days is getting up, you know, making it through the day. I'm conscious and I'm interested in hearing what you think. What are some techniques, tactics, even just a mindset that can support people to kind of process along the way some of that emotional debt before it becomes, you know, so large that it's, you know, difficult to turn to?
That's a great question. I think these days it takes courage to get up. I would say every day. It's not only in these times. We never know what people are dealing with. You know, you can look perfectly fine and, you know, between quotes, or normal, functioning on the outside. We never know what people are dealing with. I think it takes courage to keep showing up for our own journey day after day, and the learning and the letting go. So I would just give that as a bit of context. It's interesting that this idea of emotional debt, it's the first time I've come across that specific language, but what I see working with people who are purpose-driven, and whether that's in my consulting practice or as a coach, there's an alignment with values, and there's showing up with integrity and authenticity, and you know when you're on the right track, and you know when things are off. Now, sometimes that feeling things are off is a little whisper and a little sort of irritating, grating whisper.
Sure.
But it will build up, right? And so that debt accumulates, and it will build up to the point where it floors us, whether that's emotionally, physically, burnout, whatever. Because it is accumulating. So you're asking about ways to get around that, or ways to process that. Some of the
kind of along the way, I guess, right? I know that you're a
not letting it.
Forest bathing practitioner, and I know that you've explored a whole range of different ways to kind of work with this stuff.
I think first comes awareness. I think really first comes things feel off. That conversation at work today wasn't right, or what they're asking me to do. I mean, I work a lot with communicators as well, because my background is in sustainability communications. People being asked to communicate things that they don't believe in, or represent, you know, an organization that they don't really feel is fully living its values. You know, we've got lots of companies out there with wonderful reports and strategies and winning all the prizes at the sustainability circus. But when it comes to it, if you have to go work there every single day, there's going to be some things that are not aligned with the values that the company says it has, and with your own values, which took you to that place in the first place. So I think awareness, like recognizing when something is off. I know in my own life, you know, I feel tired, I feel exhausted. Well, okay, but what's behind that? Yes, I feel tired or exhausted, and sometimes it's because I didn't sleep enough. But what is behind it? What is out of alignment? You know, am I feeling like I'm moving in the right direction? And it's so up and down, even for those of us who do some of this work. It is, but, you know, we're human, right? We can't get it right all the time, and we certainly shouldn't be putting people on a pedestal for their courageous acts, because I believe that everyone is brave, everyone is showing up and doing the best that they can. That's also the trauma-informed approach, actually. No one is broken, there's nothing to fix. We're all just doing the best that we can. That was an eye-opener to me.
I beg to differ, because I've spent my whole life fixing myself, Catherine. But apart from that, I completely agree.
I hear you, me too. But perhaps, what if there was nothing to fix? What if this was your journey of accepting and getting to know yourself better? But there's nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong with Scott. Why would there be something wrong with Scott? Scott's a beautiful human being, you know?
I can't disagree with you on that point, I have to say. One thing you mentioned, which I think is already like a really, I don't know, it landed really powerfully for me, at this stage of awareness is just asking that question, what's behind this feeling? You know, almost with a curiosity. There might be nothing behind it, right? But how often do we just feel tired and we just accept it's tired? We say, I'm just tired.
I don't feel crap, whatever.
We don't ask that second question, right? You know, what's behind that? And then maybe what's behind that?
Exactly.
And that feels like a very powerful question of self-inquiry, just to allow yourself space to explore that.
Yeah, I think that's something that got really emphasized for me through mindfulness practice and just learning to question. I mean, you mentioned that I'm a journalist by background, by training. So I was always questioning everything and being a bit of a pain in the butt with it, really. But it led me into a nice career in sustainability and in credibility, because most of my work is about credibility. And, you know, is this right? So I was in a position of questioning always the external factors. But I think even going to therapy for years, I don't think I necessarily was questioning the internal factors that much.
Wow. Yeah.
And it was really coming into contact with some of the mindfulness teachings, and specifically the writings of Thich Nhat Hanh, that really helped me to question and ask this question, are you sure? And I've used that question with in coaching situations, you know, where people are telling you black is white. Really just asking that, you know, are you sure that's the case? That they really feel that, because everything is our perception. Everything is our, you know, our reality is just how we perceive it. And you could have the same reality as me, but you would perceive it differently. So, yeah, that awareness, that questioning of what's actually going on. But saying that, also giving yourself a break, because you can drive yourself totally round the bend with constantly questioning. And as we said earlier, we are in a time of chronic stress, and sometimes we do just need to retreat or you know, I think, you know, even things like numbing out, you know, if there's an awareness that you're doing it, I'm not saying I recommend it, but I know myself, I do it. Who doesn't do it at times? And if there's an awareness about it, and that it serves you in some way, it's like, you know, I've given my best all day, you know, at work, doing two different businesses, consulting and coaching, and community work. Yeah, sometimes I just want to sit on the couch by the fire, and that's okay.
Yeah,
that's totally okay.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's reminding people that there isn't a particular way to do this, right? There isn't a right way to do this.
No, and I think that's one of the things we need to let go of, actually, this idea. And I was very, when I was running the consultancy, really in my 30s, and I was living in the office, you know, it was 16.
Yeah.
I was very attached to this idea that there's a right way to do things. And I must say, since I'm in my 40s, I've done my best to let that go, because there are many different ways. And the things that we need, or the things that our clients need, also change over time. The market changes, what people can afford changes, you know, everything changes all the time.
Yeah.
So holding on to this idea of one right way, it's also not really helping.
It's a, you know, we've arrived at this really interesting part of this conversation, which is kind of getting quite Buddhist, actually, or getting at least quite dualistic in its thinking. But it reminds me actually where we are of the writing of Pema Chodron as well, with her work on groundlessness, you know, the fact that we are rarely actually in control, and, you know, a level of acceptance about the fundamental, you know, out of controlness of life, and how we can hold, you know, our center when everything around us is falling apart. And, you know, I know when the sort of first lockdown happened in the UK, I went back, I reread Things Fall Apart.
That's a good one.
And you know, it's just a great short book, actually, with lots of, you know, one thing I love about Pema Chodron is I don't think she doesn't write like a mystic or a monk or anything like that. She really tells it like it is, I think. But there's that great kind of, you know, I don't want to imply that, you know, just by by accepting things, all the suffering goes away. I don't think it's that easy, no. But certainly I found a lot of solace in her writing, and in some of the writing of the Stoics as well, who again sort of emphasise that, a bit like Frankl, that it's our meanings that we ascribe to things that, you know, we have control over, and by exercising control over what we do with the things that happen to us, we kind of can at least hold on to that center, as it were.
Yeah, exactly. And we can always come back to ourselves. But I mean, I think there's a context there too, where I have to acknowledge that I have been incredibly lucky during this almost 1 year of lockdowns and pandemic. I mean, I work from home. I have a garden. I have access to the woods. I have a dog who makes me get outside. Mm. I mean, I'm not on the front line, so it's really easy for me to sit and spout about, you know, awareness and Pema Chodron, and it's all very beautiful. But I mean, I think without an acceptance or a sense of gratitude that, wow, we are so incredibly lucky. This is tough. You know, these are difficult times for everybody, but not everybody is in the absolute, you know, front of it, the firing line, as it were.
Yeah, and I think you will have heard, I'm sure, as well, that analogy, you know, people saying we're in the same boat, and, you know, people kind of responding saying, well, we may be going through the same stormy sea, but we're in radically different vessels, a lot of people as well.
Yeah, not the same boat, exactly.
No,
and when you look at everything that's been going on in the US last year, and I mean, it has been a challenging time, not just with the pandemic.
Yeah.
But I feel like, I don't know how you feel about it, but there seems to be I feel like there is a change taking place. There is more awareness coming, and I might just be telling that to myself to have something positive to hold on to. But I feel like there's I don't want to say awakening, because that tends to be, you know, so spiritually implied. But
of course.
Do you feel like the tide is turning around some of these big issues?
Yeah. So I was having a conversation with this with my wife just the other day, actually, and I think what the pandemic has done, and you might say, you know, the political situation in the US as well, and, you know, I feel like it has just shone a light on a lot of things in ways that we now can't, we can't sit with the comfortable lie that we have a very robust economy, for example, you know, that that endless growth will save us all as long as we keep spending on things. You know, the pandemic sort of shows us that, you know, we have a very fragile economy, in fact, that, you know, many people are working poor. They're working a lot, and they just don't have what they need. That the people in some of our most valuable and important roles are, you know, have been, it's like a death by a thousand cuts. You know, if we think about, I'm talking specifically about the UK here, obviously, but I imagine similar situations are taking place in other countries too. But the systemic sort of underfunding of public service, the challenge, the growing kind of health burdens that we face, and I feel like what the pandemic has done is it's laid those things bare in such a way that, you know, the truth is really exposed, and it's becoming harder and harder to look away. You know, I feel
it takes courage to look.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I found it for myself recently, actually, thinking how much of my work is actively addressing the biggest challenges that we face. And that's a question I'm continuing to ask myself, because I think it's quite easy to what you mentioned earlier. In fact, it's easy to sort of sit within a comfort zone, actually, to build a business that serves those who already have and can afford to pay. And maybe doesn't look to really tackle some of the more challenging, intractable problems that we face that actually, you know, cause the most suffering. And one thing that made me think about this, actually, is in fact your bio, the bio that you shared. You know, I love this positioning you have, coaching leaders and change makers to help them make the most of the opportunity they have, right? Because those leaders, those change makers, the potential of impact they can have in the world is greater than perhaps you know, somebody else at a lower point in their career or with a different access to influence. So I love this positioning that's like the lever that you can pull as a coach of these people is to have, you know, this ripple effect, this larger impact on the big challenges.
Well, it's one of the things that keeps me up at night. It's probably one of my greatest fears that we will waste, and I will waste this opportunity that I have now to make change in the world. And it's change that is needed. Mm. And so the consequence of us missing that opportunity or wasting that opportunity is really, you know, it's fatal. You know, what happens next is we fry, right? If we don't do what needs to be done now, we fry. And then it doesn't matter how comfortable you are, because you won't be then. And I mean, I've always worked with pretty senior people in companies and startups as a consultant. But I reached a point where, I mean, I really enjoy my consulting work, but I reached a point of realization where I thought that we need to go into this a little bit more, you know, that people that are, they have this opportunity to make change, but maybe the organization is not supportive, or, you know, especially in sustainability, people who, they're very much fated when they get the awards and the shiny, you know, reports and things, but when they need budget or resources to do things, they don't get them. So it's very much a surface, superficial thing. I felt really that I sometimes wanted to go deeper with my clients, like what is going on with them? Why are they driven to do this work? What is holding them back? What support do they need? And I think as a trauma-informed coach of leaders and change makers, that's really the impact that I'm hoping to have over the long term, or at least, you know, for this next step in my working life. And I think we're getting to an age where we have to think we're not going to be doing this forever. You know, we've got to, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 more good years of being able to have an impact. And I think not just drifting along is also something that takes courage, because it really requires us to look at our lives and look at our impacts and be brutally honest with ourselves about what's going on and what we need and how we can contribute.
Yeah, that completely resonates. I was reflecting on Martin Luther King Jr. Day on the courage required for me to be more of an ally, in fact, you know, not just to read the right books and, you know, sound erudite on a topic, but to act, right? To risk it.
Yeah.
You know, to step out.
Yeah, it's a commitment.
Yeah, that's it. And what really strikes me is, you know, among, I'm sure, the many different things that are going on for the leaders that you coach, you know, the topic of courage is a big one, right? You know, how do you, summon the courage, choose the courage to step into an uncomfortable conversation with the board, or to, face up to an environmental reality that is at odds with the economic direction of the market, for example. And I can only imagine those are incredibly difficult conversations and actions to take with many stakeholders impacted.
Yeah, indeed. And I mean, it's extremely difficult and challenging. And that's why I think, you know, if a leader is in the position to have extra support, it can only help them in pushing these things through and not losing themselves in the process. I mean, this is the thing that we see over and over again in the sort of what I'll call the activist community or the sustainability community, is people are so attached to their fights and the issues and wrestles here, you know, the law that you're trying to get changed or the amendments that you're trying to push through. And it's all incredibly important. But at the end of the day, people are so attached to those situations that when they don't go according to plan, it's an absolute soul blow for people. And I've seen people burn out terribly because the changes they were trying to make didn't happen. So we also have to learn to balance that personal growth and personal work. And again, we said, you know, that awareness and acceptance with the change that we're trying to make in the world. And another thing that I really see from the activist and sustainability community is a lot of the times we are out there and we are trying to prove ourselves, you know, and I think that there's a good bit of personal work that it would help if it was done first before putting all of the energies on trying to change something external. And we don't have much time. I've said that already. Like, we are in trouble in terms of climate and environmental and social justice, but there is personal work needed to help ourselves, you know, find that grounding that you talked about, to be able to sort of sustain the knocks and the blows that will come from being an activist, because it's tough. You know, compassion fatigue is a real thing. I reached a point in my career when I just thought, I'm not making a difference. I've been doing this for 10 years and I'm not making a difference. And I went through that sort of cycle of compassion fatigue.
Yeah.
And just you lose your sense of agency. You lose your sense of motivation. And that was really, really hard. And now I try to help people with that as well, because I see, you know, how closely linked that is to making a difference in the world and being able to take care of ourselves. But we need to be sustainable as activists and as sustainability people.
Entirely kind of resonates. I'm reminded of Meg Wheatley's work around this topic as well. I think, you know, she's written quite a bit and spoken quite a bit about burnout within the kind of activist space as well. I want to shift gears a little bit, if that's all right with you, because I'm really...
Of course.
I'm not sure how they relate, but I'm curious how you might join the dots between credibility, this area of your work that I think is really, I don't know, you can speak to it, but it's come into, you know, it's become a much larger part of your work and how you position yourself in your work too, in your consultancy work. What connection do you see between credibility and courage?
Oh, so much. Yeah, that's great. Mm. Thank you. It takes courage to stand up and be counted. Credibility to me is about honesty. So in terms of what a company or an organization is saying to the world, it's about transparency and honesty and accountability. But when it's credibility in terms of leadership, it's also about, you know, standing up and being seen. And that's extremely scary. We're not wired to stand up and be seen. We're wired to keep putting one foot in front of the other and don't rock the boat. So it takes a huge amount of courage to really say that credibility is important, and not just to, you know, one leader or one sustainability director, but throughout the values of a company. And I mean, I've seen that with many of the companies that I work with. They bring me on because they believe that credibility and honesty and transparency is so important. But, you know, it's not a fair fight always, because so many of the companies out there are saying whatever they want about what they're doing. And the reason I started actually as a sustainability communications consultant back in, well, I set up the firm back in 2008. I was already doing it before that. Mm. But I was horrified by the greenwashing. You know, greenwashing is when a company or an organization makes a claim that something is greener or better for the environment than it actually is. And very often they make those claims without having any, you know, scientific data behind it. Mm. And I was absolutely horrified by everything that I saw. This was, you know, 12 odd years ago, and it was even worse then than it is now. And I just thought, I don't know.
Presumably as a journalist too, right? You're asking for these statements to be backed up, right? You're looking, okay, where's the evidence that this is what's taking place? You're asking that second question of these companies.
Yeah, exactly. And what's the source, and show me the data. And I mean, that journalist training has stood me in such good stead throughout my career, because, you know, in anything, but especially in sustainability, you know, we need to question and we need to ask the questions. And I'll often say to companies that are considering working with me as a consultant, like, I'm going to ask the tough questions. And if you want a consultancy that's just going to say yes, just go anywhere else but here, because I'm going to ask the tough questions. And if they can't take that, then it's not a good fit. But the ones that can take it, then you can really achieve some great results and just get that culture of credibility and those values of credibility and authenticity and integrity. It, to me, that's just how it should be. And it's, of course, sad that it isn't always like that. But that, for me, that's the way it needs to be if we want to survive.
Yeah, and listen, I'm struck by, you know, how powerful that focus on credibility is right now in the world we're living in, which is beset by a crisis of truth. You know, a crisis of, whether you call it fake news or whatever, you know, it has always been this way, but maybe never as kind of pronounced as it is at the moment. This ability for, you know, information to be manufactured, distributed twice around the world before there's even a fact check on anything. And, you know, how to, you know, what would you say, I'm curious about this one, what would you say are the great benefits of credibility for the companies that you consult with? You know, what, I mean, I can imagine that it sets them apart in, you know, in the work that they do in a massive way, but I'm curious to hear from you, like, what's the great value that it delivers when they step into their work with this kind of level of credibility?
Well, in pure business terms, it's risk management, because a company's reputation is everything. The reputation is their best asset. Even I work with many technology companies. Even I think their technology or their intellectual property is not as important as their reputation. And so by you know, deciding that they're going to show up and be honest, that's all we're talking about. It's easy to say credibility and authenticity and all these beautiful words that I do love. But at the end of the day, we're just talking about telling the truth and being honest. And if you flip that, it's like not lying. So it's a very basic thing. But in business terms, I see it as risk management, you know, being able to see these are your risks, these are the areas that you need to improve. I audit companies, I do a credibility audit, and that's really where I'm going in and saying, well, you know, you have a risk here, this is a potential issue for you, and then, you know, if I can help them fix it or help them find the right people to help them fix it. But it's, that to me is just good business. Risk management is an essential part of business. And so I hope that in the future this will really just become not just Catherine Sheridan in Brussels, this little thing, but it will become a real thing that's part of a business strategy and a business risk assessment.
Absolutely. Were you always the person asking uncomfortable questions? I guess we're returning to the question I often start with, but I'm curious, you know, where does, because it strikes me as it's a courageous place to be the one asking the uncomfortable questions of people. You know, you're putting yourself on the front line there if you're the journalist, right? Or if you're the consultant who, because you could make a lot more money, I'm sure, by not
asking for sure
uncomfortable questions, right? I mean, you could do just fine selling the services that you already have, the many skills that you have, right? But by also adding this kind of this edge to the work that you're doing. And so I'm curious, where does that come from? Do you, you know, have you always been this way, Catherine, I guess?
Yeah, I think so. I think we should call my mom. I think I've always been a bit of a pain. A bit of a pain, like asking the questions. I don't remember being very little, so I can't really find any examples of that. But yeah, I think I've always had a good radar. And I believe that we all have it. All we're talking about is an intuitive, instinctive sense that this is right. We talked at the beginning about, you know, knowing when things are off. This is just an extension of that. What you're telling me doesn't seem right, doesn't feel right.
It's a real felt sense in a way then.
Yeah. It's my radar. I've trained people. I've had a lot of people coming through my team over the years, and I've trained them in the radar, so it's totally teachable. Because I believe that we all have it. We all know when things aren't right. We all know when someone's not trustworthy, because that's our again survival, coming back to the part we talked about, trauma. But it's our body and our nervous system's conditioning to know when things are not right.
Yeah. What strikes me about that is how important it is for us to get really connected to ourselves, to tune into that very delicate instrument that we already have, you know, not to add. I know Brené Brown talks about kind of suiting up, putting the armor on, you know, great to protect us from external threats, but it also prevents us from connecting with ourselves internally, right?
Yeah, and I think it's hard and it's scary to show up, you know, professionally and personally. It's hard because not everyone else is in that place. So we can feel quite disconnected. If you show up hoping, this happens to me a lot, if you show up hoping to have a real conversation, because I live for real conversations, what I would consider a real conversation anyway, you know, a heartfelt conversation talking about the real stuff. and you show up for a conversation and it's not that, that can be quite disappointing, and that can leave me feeling quite isolated as someone who really wants to have real conversations. And then I think it's no shock that professionally I've gone to situations where I have these really close and supportive relationships with either consulting or coaching clients, because I just I just live to have those conversations.
I love that. That's the entire reason I've decided to write more and publish more. And my reflection last year is I wrote hundreds of thousands of words last year, but I just wrote them all in my journal. You know, they were incredibly powerful. They shifted things, you know, amazingly for me. They were, you know, really brilliant words, but I didn't share them with anyone because they were for me. And I was reflecting on this and thinking, well, you know, I'm a coach. It'd be good to put some of my thoughts out there. But actually, when I really connected with the why do I want to do that? Is the real need is I love nothing more. I feel most alive when I'm having a really connected conversation with somebody about something that they're passionate about, that they care about, that really matters. You know, I always talk about this as like big talk, right? I can do small talk. I'm good at small talk, right? I've well practiced, done all the networking, blah, blah, blah. But I'm not really interested in small talk. I want big talk. And so for me, understanding that, I was then like, Christ, now I know what my motivation for writing is. My writing, I want to put out there so I can get some of those conversations to happen, right? So I can invite more people into these sorts of conversations.
Yeah. Do you ever have that feeling when you press publish that you're like, oh, God, what did I just do? This one's going to be the one that finishes me off. They're never going to, they're all going to unsubscribe. No one is going to talk to me again. There's like that vulnerability, that fear of pushing publish. And I generally write and then publish, because if I would come back to it the next day, and I'm sure as a communicator, I wouldn't advise that. But this is basically what I do, because if it's coming from the heart, I'm like, this has got to go out.
Yeah.
And I hit send or publish. And then the next day I think, oh God, it's going to come falling down on me this time. I've gone too far this time. And you know what? It doesn't.
It doesn't.
And people write back and say, oh, isn't that interesting that people then write back and say, oh, thank you for sharing this. And
Do you know what? I'm always so struck by how often the truth is like, you know, it slices through things in the purest and cleanest way. So yes, sometimes it lands heavily, you know, sometimes honesty is kind of feels like a blunt force trauma, right? But it almost never in my experience leads to really negative consequences. When something's really true and it's offered, you know, in the, I won't say in the right way, but it's offered honestly, it sets people free. I see it all the time, you know. And I think it may not feel like freedom when it arrives, but it often is. It's often what we're lying to ourselves about. And when we come to terms with the lie that we're telling ourselves, you know, the truth that we've been given starts to really kind of set us free as well. So I think, you know, and so in January, I started on January the 4th, and I think I published pretty much, you know, a short essay about courage basically every day since then. And yeah, you know, like I'm just making stuff up, right? In my head, I'm drawing connections, I'm finding topics to write about, and I'm publishing them. And I've no doubt there's some people out there who are thinking, God, this is dull. Why on earth would anyone write about this? Or, you know, what was he thinking? This topic isn't interesting or even good, right? But I'm not writing for them. To some extent, I'm writing really for me. I'm exploring this topic for myself to better understand it. And what I've noticed actually is, you know, that desire of mine to end up in deep conversations that matter, you know, it's happening a lot more. And the reason it's happening is, you know, I'm inviting people in to think about courage, and that's a big topic. You know, as soon as we turn to think about these larger topics, if we step out of the busy stream of life, even for a few moments, to reflect on what the term courage means, for example, I think it takes people into that place where a slightly deeper conversation is possible about what they really think and what they feel. You know, a conversation, dare I say, that has the potential to be more honest because of that.
I think when you're doing that, when you're publishing, you are showing up, and what you're doing now is a beautiful example of showing up. And I love following what you're doing and all the experiments that you're doing. And I think like when we go out into, you know, a professional world, you and I have both got, you know, corporate backgrounds and agency backgrounds, and And I think it's quite rare then when my subscribers get a newsletter that's talking about something real, that does stand out. And yeah, I lose a few subscribers. Every time I send something that's more personal, I lose a few.
Yeah.
And I wish them well, you know, because then it's not, they're not
absolutely
needing to receive what I'm trying to share. But yeah, when you say you write for you, I'm exactly the same. I tend to think, oh, no one's going to read this. And of course they do. But if you write for yourself and it's honest and it's done with kindness, not the brutal, radical honesty, but kind honesty.
Yeah. I think it continues to surprise me that when, you know, I'm part of a men's group, have been for a couple of years. I would say it's probably one of the most important factors in my life, in fact, you know, because alongside, you know, my most significant relationships, my partner, my wife Carla, you know, my son Marshall, my parent, who I get on with really well, and my siblings. You know, this men's group is a place where there's a lot of fierce courage being shown. You know, people really saying what they think. And it's amazing that container can allow for that. And I'm just struck how often, you know, we're telling ourselves, oh, the other person, I shouldn't say it because they won't be able to handle it,
mm-hmm.
right? And how often we're wrong about that. You know, how often the people that we're worried about hurting their feelings, they're more resourceful than we think, and the truth is a really powerful tool. You know, it has to be used very kind of judiciously, but I think you know, most of the time I feel like we're not really being as honest as we can be. And so if you step, you know, for me, part of the courage experiment is like, where am I not being honest with myself? You know, where am I not being clearer with myself about what I want to achieve in my work, or what impact I want to have in the world, you know? And what's a step one in the direction of where I want to go? Not now I need to totally change my life and leap miles into the future and do some big, bold act of courage. More like, let's explore the edges of my comfort zone on this topic. Let's stop kind of telling myself the comfortable lie. You know, this is fine. And instead sort of say, what's a little bit more than this? You know, oh, God, feels a bit edgy. Okay, great, let's explore that. And, you know, if we can make it fun, you know, you know, these things can feel very heavy and can be triggering. You know, it's very important to emphasize that, you know, moving towards where we have fear can be a trigger for previous events as well. So that's why I think it's especially especially important that we're careful. I think it really helps if you can do it with somebody else who understands. You know, there's nothing like having an ally, you know, whether it's a professional coach, whether it's a counselor, whether it's just a good friend who wants to do that with you. I've taken a few people to go for sea swims now, and I'm struck by how important it is when we're showing up in a way that's slightly more courageous than we have before, to have someone alongside you who's just there, you know, just another body who's there with you, you know, holding that space with you can be hugely valuable. Trying to be more honest with myself is kind of my theme for the year. Although I'm writing about courage in January, I'll be writing about a different topic each month of this year. Courage is my word for the year. In fact, it's the quality or the virtue. It's often, you know, talked about as a virtue because I guess Aristotle had it in his virtues, but I would just call it a quality or a characteristic. It's that quality and characteristic that I would like to show more of this year. And so I'll be exploring it throughout the year. January is very specifically focused on it. But the other months of the year, I'm sure, will provide me with lots of opportunities to practice courage. No doubt I'll have to kind of revisit some of the things I thought about it throughout the rest of the year too. I've got a little bit of an ace in the hole. Maybe it's not an ace in the hole, but I know something about you, Catherine. You know, don't worry. But I'm curious. I think it's something I've remained curious about. We did a little bit of coaching work together, and I remember we had this really interesting serendipitous moment where I mentioned in one of our sessions Marie Colvin, the war correspondent, who had, I think, passed away, and she had a documentary film made about her. And you mentioned that, you know, as a youngster, you had aspirations to be a war correspondent. And so I just wanted I wanted to just come back to that and sort of say, what is it about a war correspondent that, that at the time, you know, felt intriguing or attractive?
Gosh, that's a really good question. I don't have that same connection to it now as I did then. But I think, I know, I grew up on, I actually thought about joining the army as well before, which my people who know me now can't believe. a war correspondent, you know, they are courageous, they are brave, they go in and they tell the truth. They go in, or at least to the best of their abilities, and it has changed. But I'm talking about, you know, the Kate 80s and the reporters of our youth in Britain.
Yeah.
Who, you know, were not embedded with troops for their own safety and so they could receive the news that they wanted them to receive. But, you know, people that really went out there, and there's something sort of sacrificial about it.
Yeah.
It's putting your life on the line for the greater good. And I think that, you can pull that to pieces now for sure. But that is, or that was the motivation that I had behind, you know, the idea of serving. Whether that was, you know, in the military or as a war correspondent. And yeah, I mean, I thought being a war correspondent would be incredibly exciting. And I became a journalist, but not in the same capacity. But I do. It is always something that I thought would have been super, super exciting. And I've read so many books, you know, the dispatches type reports. And I'm sure there's a lot of, you know, glorifying of it all. But that was definitely something that reached me as a youngster.
Yeah, and I'm struck by the sort of it's kind of rather more in that category of very public courage in a way, or the very kind of large acts of courage where, you know, our lives are on the line, sort of thing.
Yes.
And sexy as hell, I think, in a way. You know?
Yeah, it's heroic, isn't it? It's sexy. Whereas now I'm saying what's really heroic and sexy is showing up every day and being alive. And that is enough.
Yeah, and we don't seem to be telling those same stories as often as we were. Do you think there's been a shift, perhaps? You know, perhaps we're a bit more jaded about the kind of heroic and courageous narrative. Do you think there's been a shift slightly around that?
I'd like to hope so, but I don't know that there has. And that's where I think that your men's group story is so important. I would really hope in the next, you know, few years that we see men's groups cropping up everywhere, because it's so needed. Because so much of this, and I mean, I'm in the entrepreneur world as well, but there's so much of this hustle narrative that you must work yourself to death and it's heroic not to sleep. And I mean, it's a total nonsense, because if we don't take care of ourselves, we can't bring our things and our gifts out into the world. It's just not possible. So I would like to think that there has been a shift, but that may also just be that I've gotten older and exposed to different things. I'm not sure that in the culture at large there has been a huge shift. I think we still love to look at celebrity culture. I mean, the things that we as a culture put on a pedestal are not the right things.
Yeah. I mean, I'm actually just, it's funny, I don't think I've watched the show, but it's so pervasive that, you know, it's impossible to avoid. But I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here strikes me as a really unusual thing, like where we take famous people and we put them under incredible stress and pressure, and then we watch for our pleasure. I mean, it's a really unusual thing, right?
It's a very strange form of voyeurism. I'm not into any of those kind of shows, but it is very strange, you know. And the need that some of those people feel to really, and this is judgmental now, but if you're one of those minor celebrities, and the need that you seem to have to put yourself out there and to be, you know, to be adored, and I just want to do my work and help people if I can. That's enough.
Beautiful. I don't know about you, but that I want to finish on that note. I feel like
that's a good place to stop.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Catherine, thank you so much. Look, I hope and I certainly feel like this has been one of those conversations. I know it has been for me, and I'm so grateful to you for the time that you've taken and for the way that you've, you know, thrown yourself into this topic as well.
I always enjoy talking with you, so thank you.
Magic. Catherine, go well, and I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
Thanks, Scott, and good luck with your next experiments and adventures.
I'll keep you posted.
I'm supporting from the sidelines as you dip in the sea in the morning.
Wonderful, wonderful. I'll get next Thanks. Time you're over here, I'll get you into the sea for sure.
We'll do that maybe in the summer.
Yeah, brilliant.
Thanks. Bye.
No problem, bye.